We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go! Alvarez ties the game!
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
How y'all doing today? You feeling good? You happy? It's sunny outside. It's almost the summer. I feel awful. I feel sick. And there are times I wonder why I care this much about sports. Seriously, have we all wondered this at times? Like, it's fun. We debate the DH and double switches and quarterbacks, top 10 of all time. It's all fun. We have a great time watching sports and debating sports and talking sports. Most people listening, you've done it your entire life. But as I sit here today, how many hours are we away? About 10 hours away from Game 7 between the Brooklyn Nets and the Milwaukee Bucks. I say this to you, whether you're a Net fan, a Knicks fan, or you don't care about basketball, here's what you know. You know Game 7s and what they mean. And you know that when there's a Game 7 not involving your team, we all say the same thing. Game 7s are great. They're awesome. They're so much fun. The two best words in sports, Game 7. Let me tell you something. There is nothing fun about Game 7. Nothing. Nothing fun. I have been miserable for 24 hours. Now, if you want to say to the radio, Evan, there's something wrong with you. You care too much. That's fine. Maybe I do. Maybe at 37 years old, I shouldn't care as much as I do. But guess what? As a diehard fan, I do, and a lot of us do. So again, even if you're not a Net fan or a Knick fan or even a basketball fan, let's say you're a Yankee fan, you know what Game 7s are all about. You remember how you felt going into Game 7 of the ALCS in 2017? We can go back further. You certainly remember how you felt going into Game 7 of 2004's ALCS or 2003's ALCS or Game 7 of the World Series in 2001. You know how you feel. And here's the other thing that you know. You remember those games for the rest of your life. Now, you may remember them for great reasons, for amazing reasons, but you also may remember them for awful, horrible reasons. Now, I just use the Yankees as an example. And if you're a Yankee fan, let's say 30 and above, 35 and above, you've had a lot of these. You have. You've had a lot of them. And some of them have been really bad. You know, we talk about the Yankees having all this great success, and they have. They've had a lot of bad moments in a Game 7. 2004 was awful. No Yankee fan will ever forget that feeling that you had against the Boston Red Sox in 2004. No Yankee fan will certainly ever forget how you felt in 2001. You'll remember how you felt in 03. That was amazing. Aaron Boone's probably why he's the manager right now. As a Met fan, I haven't had a lot of them. And for the sake of this, we could take the Game 5s out. Right? We could push the Game 5s to the side. Winner take all Game 5s. They certainly exist. We've all experienced them. But Game 7. Game 7. I have experienced in my lifetime being in attendance for three Game 7s featuring my own team. And for the Met fan out there, and we'll get to the Mets and Yankees from last night, don't worry. All right, I'm not going to bore you with 2.5 hours of Game 7s and being a sick, twisted Nets fan. Don't worry. We'll talk Nets. We actually do that around here. And Net fans actually call in and we talk about it. I know it's a rare occurrence. But we haven't had a lot as Met fans. And obviously 2006 is a killer. I mean, every Met fan listening right now thinks back to many moments from that game. Like, that game, you know, it's not just Beltran striking out. It's not just Yadier hitting the home run, and it's not just Indy's catch. Those are the three things that are probably the headlines from that game. But there's so many other things from that game that haunt me as a Met fan and other Met fans. Having a runner on third with less than two outs after Rowland makes the throwing error in the inning after Andy Chavez made the great catch. Even Jose Reyes is at bat in the ninth. Do you remember this? Right off the bat, line drive. I thought for a second it was going up the alley, and Jim Edmonds made a great, not a great, but a good running catch. You remember all of these things. And certainly, for those who are Net fans, the last time they hosted a Game 7 in their own building, in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, in the history of the Nets in the NBA, they have only hosted one other Game 7. They did host a Game 5 against Indiana, one of the great moments in Net history. But Game 7 would be 2013 against Chicago. That's it. And that was awful. That still haunts me. And I was texting Ryan Rucco before the show. I'm not doing a carton name drop. It's just Ryan Rucco broadcast the Nets, and he's a good guy. And I said to him, because he asked me, are you confident? Like, how are you feeling? And I said, no, I'm not confident. I'm expecting the worst. And I'll give you basketball reasons, by the way. I will. I'll give you real concrete basketball reasons why I'm not confident. But one of the non-rational reasons, which I admit I'm not going to be fully rational today, I want to be honest about that, is I keep thinking back to that night in 2013 where the Nets were taking on just a depleted Chicago Bull team. They had come back from 3-1 down the Nets. They had a Game 7 in their own building, and they just played from behind from the beginning. And it never felt like a game they could win, and they lost on their home court. It was embarrassing, and it led to the trade that Billy King made a few months later, or basically a month later, with the Boston Celtics. A game like that haunts me. Now, I did see them win a Game 7 in Toronto, but that's a different country. That doesn't even count. I didn't see it in Brooklyn or New Jersey or Queens. I saw it in Toronto. That does not, in fact, that don't count. So, you know what? We throw that one away. But I remember everything about that game, remember everything about 2013, and for Yankee fans and Met fans, and certainly Islanders and Rangers fans, I leave the hockey out, I shouldn't. There have been so many Game 7s between the Islanders and Rangers, especially the Rangers, over the last two decades. Tons of them. Game 7s in the NHL feel more routine. Feels like it's just more common. But for the Knicks fan out there, and this is not me taking a shot, they haven't played a Game 7. Do you know the last time the Knicks played a Game 7? You got to go all the way back. And I'm telling you, half the audience wouldn't even remember this, depending on your age. 2000, second round, Miami Heat. And they won a Game 7 on the road. That's a long time ago. So these are rare, especially for the New York basketball fan. If we just stick with Knicks and Nets, these don't happen often. There aren't a lot of Game 7s in the history of the Nets. There are more with the Knicks, but you got to go back to the 90s, essentially, to find those Game 7s. So this is going to be a night for Net fans, for NBA fans, because I think if you're a basketball fan, you have to be into tonight. This is going to be a night you never forget. Now, why am I not confident from a basketball standpoint? I'll give you a few real quick, and we will get to all the baseball. Jacob DeGrom hurt himself swinging. I get it. I've been getting a ton of DMs about it. Hey, Evan, Jake hurt himself swinging. Care to comment? I'll comment. Don't worry. We'll get into all that later. The Yankees, it's all coming. Here are my basketball reasons. Number one, Joe Harris. Let's start with him. He's been abysmal. He's been pathetic. And look, I don't want to go too far. I'm not ripping him personally, obviously. I love Joe Harris. Every Net fan loves Joe Harris. They need Joe Harris. And since Game 3, he's been abysmal. Now, he had a couple of shots late in Game 6, even though it didn't make a difference. He also committed some god-awful fouls. Hopefully, that gives Joe confidence, because they need him. It is going to be almost impossible to expect to win this game squarely on the back of KD. Because even when you look at Game 5, that incredible, iconic performance by Durant, they were in the game because of Jeff Green. Jeff Green's performance kept them afloat. So while, yes, Durant carried them down the stretch, it was not 100% on Durant. They need other guys to step up. Now, could Jeff Green have another big-time performance? Sure. But they need Joe Harris. He has been a constant all season long, and it scares you how bad he's been since Game 3. That's number one. Number two, since Game 3, the Nets have been thoroughly outplayed. Let's just call it like it is. They haven't played well. Sure, they had a chance to close out game three when KD hit that three to go up three with a minute and a half to go, but they didn't. They didn't close the game out. We remember Bruce Brown making the decisions he made down the stretch. I get it. Game four was a mess. Kyrie gets hurt. It changes everything. And they had no ability to respond. The offense had nothing. But even in game five, this iconic game, and I don't even want to talk about how we're going to remember this game if they lose tonight, because that's a podcast. That's like a two-hour podcast to analyze what that game means if they lose. But even in that game, they were getting destroyed, and they benefited from the Bucks, who in the first half did not play the smartest game in the world. And I don't want to spend too much time on the Bucks and Giannis and how good Chris Middleton has been and some of the decisions Drew Holiday makes, because quite frankly, we're in New York. We're not doing Milwaukee Sports Talk Radio. But trust me, they have their issues too. And I'd understand why a Buck fan wouldn't be confident tonight. I get it. I understand that. And then game six. The most encouraging thing from game six was that James Harden was a factor. He wasn't the James Harden, but as opposed to looking like the 30% of Harden in game five, he was maybe the 60% of Harden in game six. He didn't have that burst. We saw him on a couple of steals basically say, I am not running any kind of fast break because I can't. But his craftiness, his ability to get to the basket, do his little floater, his step back threes, he was a weapon. Something he wasn't in game five. That's encouraging that maybe he takes another step in game seven. But what has scared me all along, and I said this before the series, are the demons the Bucks are trying to crush. And despite the injuries the Nets are facing, despite all of that, if they win a game seven in Brooklyn, they are crushing all the demons that they have. Now, I'll give you a positive, and I shouldn't do this because I should just remain negative for the next 2.5 hours. In their histories, Kevin Durant is 3-1 in game sevens. James Harden, 3-1 in game sevens. Giannis Antetokounmpo has played one game seven and they lost. It was early on in their run against Boston, but nevertheless. So the Nets have the best player on the floor. The Nets have the game seven experience and they're in their own building where they have played, despite how awful they were in the first half of game five, where they have played much better basketball and they've been the better team. But here's the irrational side of me, and I think everybody listening who's a diehard sports fan can understand this. Met fans can certainly understand this. You just don't think good things are going to happen. It's your team, and you think something awful is going to happen. Something bad is going to happen. And that's my feeling. I'll be honest. I'm not going to lie to you and say, oh, yeah, I'm cocky. I feel good. I'm nervous. And I remember a conversation my dad and I had in the midst of Game 7 against the Cardinals in 2006. I think it was as Beltran was coming up. Shea Stadium's electric. Beltran stepping to the plate. I mean, it's really what you want. You know what I mean? Like, you sign for your best hitter at the plate with the bases packed and an extra base hit sending you to the World Series. There's nothing more you can ask for. And I looked at my dad, and I don't remember if he said it to me or I said it to him, but one of us said, why do we do this to ourselves? Like, why do we like sports? This is not fun. And sure, if Beltran ripped one up the alley and everybody celebrated, yeah, we'd remember it as fun. But the game wasn't fun. It was 3.5 hours of stress. So if you're a casual fan listening, maybe you listen to me and you maybe listen to other callers today and say, I don't get it. I don't understand it. Sports is fun. But as a diehard fan, it's not. I'm nervous. I'm shaking. I'm sick. And that's how I'll be for 3 hours tonight. And hopefully, there'll be a positive result. But the one thing I know for sure is no matter what happens tonight in Brooklyn, this will be a night I will never forget. And if you're a diehard fan, you will never forget. And I'm not kidding, by the way. I'm going to be a man of my word. I said yesterday to Craig on the air with Craig, 8:15, 15 minutes before tip, there's a bar right behind about section 108, kind of in that range. Nice, beautiful bar. All of us Net fans, I'll do it. We're going to meet there. We're going to say a prayer to the basketball gods. Take a shot. If you don't drink, don't take any shot. And kind of pump each other up. Because tonight, good or bad, is a night we'll never forget. All right, we'll get to your calls coming up. A lot to say about the Mets and Yankees from last night. Yes, I'll give you my thoughts on Jacob DeGrom injuring his shoulder, swinging a bat. There's a lot to discuss. And the New York Islanders are playing a home game at Nassau Coliseum tonight, where they certainly need to bounce back. After taking game one in Tampa, the Lightning have responded. And we'll get to the keys on what they need to do to even up this series tonight and ship it back to Tampa, tied at two. And I got to tell you, it's unfortunate, and it's because of scheduling and it's because of the Nets. This run's been incredible, and I haven't been able to enjoy it the way I did last year in the bubble when there was no Nets. So I don't know how hockey basketball fans do it. Like in 1994, the Knicks and Rangers never played on the same night, and that probably made it easier for guys like Beningo and others who are Knicks and Ranger fans. But this has been brutal. Like, I admit it. I feel bad. I have not had the same passion or enjoyment or stress from this Islander run because they're always going up against the Nets. Like, I always DVR the games and I watch them or have them on a separate TV, but it's been tough. So I don't know. Maybe it was easier in 1994 because it wasn't the same night. I don't know. We'll discuss the injuries and the future of Jacob DeGrom in a little bit, but right now we do want to wish him a very happy birthday. 33 years old, Jacob DeGrom. A lot of baseball to get to coming up in just a little bit. Andrew in Brooklyn will lead it off. Andrew, how you feeling? You nervous?
Of course I'm nervous. I'm nervous and I'm scared. Look, I used to love Game 7s. So I'll watch anything if there's a Game 7, the do-or-die attitude, the finality. But I realized I hate Game 7s when your team is involved. I didn't sleep well. I got up early, and I couldn't go back to sleep. And I realized it's all because of Game 7. As for the game, what worries me most is I think Milwaukee may have found something with their bully balling in Game 6, especially with Giannis and Drew Holiday going into the lane. Vegas has the game essentially a 50-50 game. Nets are favored by a point, point and a half. After watching this series, Milwaukee is definitely the better team. They're the healthier team.
Right now they are, yes.
Yeah, they're the more healthier team, more athletic, more physical. They've been together longer. I think they're probably even slightly better coached than our team. But the key positives, as you mentioned, James looks a little more spry, a little more like himself. The game is in our building, which I think is going to be important with Giannis at the free throw line. And we have the best player in the court in Kevin Durant.
Well, you know, Andrew, that last part, like if you weren't a Net fan and I wasn't a Net fan and we were breaking down Game 7 from afar, right? And we probably only spent like 2 minutes on it, but we were giving our opinion on Bucks, non-Nets team, but same roster from afar. Here would be why we would pick the Nets. The last thing you said, because I know I have in the past. Who is the best player on the floor? If this game is close in the final 2 minutes, who do I trust? Now, on one end, for the Bucks, it's Chris Middleton. I mean, that's not even a debate. Their closer is Chris Middleton. Their closer is not Giannis Antetokounmpo. But Kevin Durant is one of the great closers we've ever seen. So if we stepped back from our biases, from our nervousness, that's the major edge the Nets have if they keep this game close. And I'll tell you about Game 6. As they trailed basically throughout the night, you know, they got off to a terrible start. I think it was 18-5 in Game 6. They kept fighting back. They kept pulling it within five, and then Middleton would hit a big shot. But my attitude was just have this be a close game with 2 minutes to go and trust that having the best player on the floor will make the difference. Because they do have that. But what you said initially is true. And do not take this as an excuse. I'm not making excuses. Injuries are a part of the game. Look at the way the LA Clippers have overcome injuries to Kawhi Leonard. Paul George has become a superstar, and Terrence Mann had the game of his life, okay? You can overcome injuries. So it's not an excuse, but if we're being fair, yeah. With the state of the Nets right now, with no Kyrie Irving and James Harden being compromised, right now the Bucks feel like the better overall team. Jason in Montgomery. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Evan, what's going on?
What's up?
Not much. Like you said, Game 7, huge tonight. I'm glad you brought it in comparison because I did have that similar feeling to the Yankees in 2017. Even though it's a long time ago now, same thing with Jets-Steelers in 2010, the AFC title game.
Yep.
So, yeah, very, very nervous stuff tonight. I think you hit it on the head. I think this game really is going to come down to the play of Joe Harris because, like you said, it's just the first two games. I thought he was really good, and I just thought yeah, this could just really make the difference. And well, you know, really since Game 3, it just hasn't shown. With the injury to Kyrie, you need those other players to step up.
You know what's scary? I thought coming home makes the difference. Because I think for role players in general, there are huge splits between how they shoot at home and how they shoot on the road. Now, why that's the case, I can't answer. But that's been going on for a while, and that's certainly been the case this year in the NBA playoffs. So what really hit me was Joe playing as poorly as he did in Game 5. I thought that was going to be the bounce-back game. And that makes you not confident that now Game 7 is going to be the bounce-back game. Kevin Durant needs help. As much as I said before, he's the best player on the floor, he needs help. In Game 5, he got it from Jeff Green. I think I said this on the halftime show. For as much as I said it was over and it's a funeral and we're dead, and I was dead wrong about it, I did say to the guys, without Jeff Green, they're down by 30, you know, as opposed to being down by 16. So they did have another guy step up, and all eyes point to Joe Harris. And I don't mean to be overly dramatic, but I guess I will be anyway. Who cares? His net career is on the line here. I'm sorry, if Joe Harris comes up small tonight in Game 7 and they're eliminated, why would you feel an attachment to keeping this guy around? I mean, great, you could shoot 50% from three during the regular season. This is not about the regular season, as we now know and should have known for a while. The regular season doesn't mean anything. Now, with that said, here's where the regular season meant something. I always said to Craig, the players may not care, Giannis may not care. I care about home court advantage. I'd rather be at home. This has been a series that so far, the home team has won every single game. And who knows, maybe that ends tonight. We'll find out. But I'd much rather have a Game 7 in my building as opposed to a Game 7 on the road. And remember how close it was between the Nets and the Bucks down the stretch on who was going to get that home court advantage. Jeff in Keyport. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Evan, how you doing today?
All right, what's up?
I feel share the same sentiments as every other Nets fan right now. I hate Game 7. I can't sleep. I'm nervous as can be. But I'm cautiously optimistic that the guy that everybody has their eyes on tonight, Joe Harris, I don't know why I feel like he's going to show up tonight and he's going to have that vintage Joey Buckets game that we need, that those threes that have been bricking lately are going to start sinking. But the one thing that I really hope this team does is they got to get out of the gate, and they got to come out of the gate strong immediately, because the past few games,
yep,
the Nets have come out struggling, they've come out sluggish, and the Bucks feel like every single game they've come out and they put up a 10 or 15 point lead immediately, and the Nets had to fight back just to get back into the game. So I think the Nets have to come out and they got to make their shots, they got to play better defense. If I were the Nets, I would put KD on Middleton. They got to make Middleton uncomfortable this game, because feels like he's had his shots all game, and he's the guy that worries me the most. And
oh, yeah.
It's Middleton, with the way he's been shooting this whole entire series. So,
dude, if they slow, Jeff, to your point, and you're right, they slow down Chris Middleton, they win tonight. I mean, Chris Middleton was outstanding in Game 6. And he's had some massive splits, too, home and road, and the way he shot the basketball. The only issue with KD defending him right from jump is it takes a lot of effort and a lot of work. And they're going to need Kevin Durant offensively. I mean, they're going to need KD to hit a ton of big shots down the stretch. I think that's a part of why, you know, it's been easy to say Giannis should defend Durant. And certainly down the stretch, you want to throw Giannis at KD, I totally get it. And they did do that in Game 6, and Giannis was effective. But if you have Giannis defending one of the great scorers in the history of basketball the entire game, you are going to wear him out. I mean, by the time we hit that 8-minute mark in the fourth quarter, how much is Giannis going to have left? But you're right, these bad starts have to stop. In Game 3, and I know they erased it really quick, they were down by 21 points in the first quarter. They were down 30-11 after one, and to their credit, they fought back and they responded. And they should have won that game. Game 4 wasn't a bad start. It really was. And again, I know this sounds like an excuse. It's not. I'm just giving you the facts. Kyrie goes down. They were dead. I mean, it was a 4-point game at that point. He goes down. They're done. They had no shot in that game. But then you look at the awful, awful start they had in Game 5. brutal, brutal start. And even the start they had in Game 6. Look, and in Game 6, they responded. They fought back. I know it turned out to be a blowout, but they pulled it within five numerous times. There was one spot where Joe Harris had a great look from a corner three, missed it down five, and I think Middleton responded immediately with like a four-point play. It was a dagger. But they've got to stop with these slow starts. Because right now, they're not the same high-powered offensive team they were during the regular season. They're not. They're not playing at a pace. They can't play fast break, let's move it up and down the court basketball because their point guard can't move. He's showing you that. And so that makes falling behind by 16 early even a tougher hill. Though if you've watched these NBA playoffs, including last night, some of these comebacks or blown leads, no matter how you want to define it, has been remarkable. I mean, the Utah Jazz last night, the Sixers, not last night, but certainly in Game 5, and even the Bucks in Game 5 against the Nets, we have seen some huge blown leads. And I don't, it's really perspective if you want to call it a blown lead or a great comeback. I guess you could kind of look at either way, really. Hey, by the way, it is time for the Wendy's Yankee Turning Point of the Game contest. Wendy's is the official hamburger of the New York Yankees. The first call to correctly identify yesterday's turning point of the game at 866-540-WFAN. You'll receive a Wendy's prize pack, including a Wendy's gift card. All right, here from your flagship station for Yankee baseball, The Fan. A lot of baseball we'll get to it coming up in the 11 o'clock hour, including what happened to the Yankees last night, concerns around the Mets who all of a sudden have a losing streak, and Jacob DeGrom's injury occurred how? It was a great night of basketball last night. Give the Sixers credit. Seth Curry played well, including a big steal down the stretch as the Sixers won Game 6 in Atlanta to bring it back to Philly for a Game 7 after they had two collapses in a row. And how about the Clippers, man? The L.A. Clippers, who at times underachieved a lot over the last decade, especially during the Lob City era. They close out the Utah Jazz. They're down huge in this game. They're without Kawhi Leonard. And Paul George, who wasn't as great in Game 6 as he was Game 5, is rewriting his script and how we feel about him. I mean, really, playoff P has a whole new meaning. But no, the story of that game was the fact that you got a guy like Terrence Mann, a second-round pick, you know, kind of a bit player for this Clipper team, stepping up and dropping 39 points on Utah. And again, it's all about perspective. Either it's the great resiliency of the LA Clippers, or it's the absolute choke job by the Utah Jazz, especially by Rudy Gobert, who, as an elite-level defensive player, did not play like one down the stretch last night. And a disappointment. Look, the Jazz were the one seed. I think they looked at the lay of the land and said, we've got a clear road or a clearer road to potentially get into the NBA Finals for the first time since 1998. Kawhi Leonard goes down with a knee injury, and you respond by losing back-to-back games. Really? I mean, well, technically four straight games, but after the Kawhi injury, back-to-back games. So you've got an LA Clipper, Phoenix Suns, Western Conference Finals. Either the Clippers are going to go to the finals for the first time in their history, or Phoenix is going to go to the finals for the first time since 1993. And even on the East End, whether it's Atlanta, Philadelphia, the Nets, or Milwaukee, you're going to have a huge drought end with a team going to the Eastern Conference Finals and then the NBA Finals. I mean, when you think about that, not the Bucks going to the Eastern Conference Finals, but you know what I mean, getting to the NBA Finals. The Nets are the most recent team to do it, which is crazy to think about, in 2003. And so we've got ourselves a Game 7 on Sunday between Philadelphia and Atlanta. And it's funny how things work. If the Nets win tonight, that's a game I am glued to. That's a game we're all glued to. And we can go back and forth on our preferences. If the Nets lose tonight, I will not watch a second of that game Sunday night. Not a second. So we'll see. We'll see. We'll get to the baseball coming up in about 15 minutes. Let's go to Anthony in the Bronx. Good morning, Anthony.
Hey, what's up, Evan? You know, as a Laker fan, a longtime Laker fan, and we out of it. You know something? And I'm a Bronx guy, Evan. I grew up in the city, and I spent most of my life in the city. So I want to see the Nets win. But two things, Evan. I want to say something about Milwaukee. I'm not Milwaukee, Utah, then I'm going to say something about the Nets.
Yeah.
The coach in Utah, these are not big-time coaches. These guys get good teams, and my point is, he let Gobert in that game yesterday when clearly he wasn't able to guard the pick and roll.
Yeah,
he should have brought in one of them other guys. That was a big, big, big mistake. The Clippers coach and his experience, he has never made those mistakes. And the thing about the Nets, Evan, I want to see y'all win so bad. You know, being a city guy, and I'm here in the city, I've been a Laker fan for over 35 years, so I'm not a bandwagon fan, and I'm not bitter. We just won a championship last year. But these Knicks fans are so jealous of the Nets. You know, they were saying, oh, who owns this city? Who cares about who owns this city? It's about championship. And if Harden can give y'all at least 70% tonight, and Kevin Durant can play big, because, Evan, I'm not sold on Milwaukee. I would only be sold on Milwaukee if they met the Clippers in the finals and they was able to beat the Clippers. Because your team, Evan, has
you'll been be, but Anthony, injuries. Anthony, you'll be sold on Milwaukee if they win tonight, despite the injuries, despite Kyrie not being there, despite Harden not being 100%, despite whatever you want to bring up, for all the talk about Milwaukee and Budenholzer doesn't know what he's doing and Giannis comes up small and Drew Holiday's shot selection, all of which have been fair critiques. They win tonight, the view of the Milwaukee Bucks is completely different. And I'll give you something confident. I think this is a confident statement, and I'm not going out on a crazy limb here. I truly feel this way. The team that wins tonight, to me, is going to the NBA Finals. Now, I've watched enough of Philadelphia, enough of Atlanta, where whether it's Milwaukee tonight, whether it's the Nets tonight, despite all the injuries, I think the winner of tonight's game is going to go to the NBA Finals. And I think your view on the Bucks is different if they win this game. Just is. You win a Game 7 on the road? That's a, quote, legacy-making game. Now, obviously, we got to see how they do it. But nevertheless, you do it, you're going to think differently about him. It's a great point about Quinn Snyder, who did a great job this year for the Utah Jazz. No doubt about it. No doubt. And they've dealt with injuries, too. It's kind of been downplayed, but Mike Conley's been banged up. And if you watched him last night, he wasn't healthy. He went out there and finally played, and he wasn't very good. And that's a big blow when you lose your starting point guard. So everybody's dealing with injuries. But it's funny. You don't watch Utah every day. You watch them from afar. Maybe some nationally televised games when they play the Knicks, when they play the Nets. But Quinn had done an amazing job this year. But you're right. The coaching job in Game 6 was absolutely brutal. And Ty Lue does deserve a ton of credit. A ton of. And speaking of coaches, if the Sixers lose Game 7, and I don't think they will, but if they lose Game 7 at home, especially after the collapses they had in 4 or 5, and the fact that the Clippers, minus Kawhi Leonard, just advanced to the Western Conference Finals. What's the view of Doc Rivers? What's the view of him? Raj in Montville. What's up, Raj?
Ev, good morning and a happy Juneteenth. And, hey, I'm a Bucks fan, all right? I'm a Milwaukee Bucks fan. I've been a Bucks fan since the Ray Allen and Big Dog days.
All right. I respect it.
So, yeah, and I got to tell you, you know, I don't want to say I'm optimistic. I don't want to say I'm confident, but I'm definitely excited. You know, I'm not nervous. I'm excited because, you know, we're not used to winning big games like these. And if we do, you know, let me tell you, it's going to be amazing. I'll give you a couple keys that I'm thinking of right now from our perspective. First of all, PJ Tucker's got to stay on the court. You know, I think the foul trouble definitely hurt us a lot in Game 5, so he's got to stay on the court. Giannis's free throw shooting. I mean, that is one thing that definitely makes me nervous. You know, I mean, it's gotten better every game, but still 40% in the series. I mean, that's a disgrace.
He was better in game. He was much better in Game 6. I know 6-for-10 is nothing to write home about, but it definitely felt like it was major, major improvement. And I don't know if being at home and being on the road makes a big difference, because you know what's going to happen tonight in Brooklyn. Everybody's going to count the number. They're going to taunt them. So I don't know what that translates to as compared to Milwaukee, where they kind of give him the silence, you know, the, okay, concentrate, Giannis.
Yeah, well, you know, but still, there's no excuse. I mean, as a buddy of mine once said, how do you miss free throws? They're free. You know, I mean, you got to be able to make your free throws. I don't care where you are. And the last thing is, as you alluded to in your intro, this has got to be, when we look back at the series, I mean, as a Bucks fan, I want this to be the Chris Middleton game, the Chris Middleton series. I mean, the guy's amazing. Like Terrence Mann, he's a second-round pick. Obviously, he's an all-star. But you know what? I want the ball in his hands, ideally with a two-man game with Giannis, even though that didn't work down the stretch in Game 5, obviously. But, you know, this has got to be the Chris Middleton series. But you know what? I'm excited and just hope it's not, you know, something dictated by the officials or an injury. Let's have a good game, Matt. Looking forward to it.
All right. Well, good luck, Raj. I wish you luck as a Buck fan. Not too much luck, though. Chris Middleton is the guy down the stretch you want the ball in the hands of. Just look back at game three. You know, look back at that. It's forgotten about a little bit because of the other things that transpired, the way Durant responded every time, the Bruce Brown shot decisions, and then Jrue Holiday hitting the eventual game winner. But Middleton hit back-to-back, clutch, ice-in-the-veins, mid-range jump shots that gave the Bucks the lead in back-to-back occasions. But he was awesome in game six. He was incredibly efficient. He got to the line a bunch of times. He missed five shots all night. And look, it's not even close. He's your best offensive player. It's weird. Giannis is your best player. I get that. He puts up all the numbers. He wins the MVPs. But down the stretch, you want the ball in the hands of Chris Middleton. He's going to be a huge key in this game. As is, you know, the Bryn Forbes, Pat Connaughtons of the world. Because if you get Bryn Forbes hitting a couple of threes off screens or Pat Connaughton doing the same, that can make a difference. That can make a huge difference. Oh, God. Just even talking about it gives me anxiety. Yeah. Greg in East Northport. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Evan, it's been an awfully long time since I've spoken to you. You've had the birth of another child. You're in drive time, all that good stuff. So congratulations on everything. I miss Joe. So if you speak to him, give him my best.
You got it, man.
I'm just wondering here now. Do you see that possibly Spencer Dinwiddie would have been the, you know, the difference in this series?
I mean, yeah. Like, look, I keep saying I don't want to make injuries as an excuse. It's not. Like, injuries are a part of the game, and it happens to every team in the NBA. The LA Lakers got knocked out in large part because of the fact they weren't healthy. Okay? So it happens to everybody. But yeah. if you want me to be honest, of course. If Spencer Dinwiddie is healthy all year, that looks different. They may get the one seed. They may be playing a completely different team. If he was healthy right now, if you just dropped him in, of course it makes a difference. This team is starving for offensive help. We know about Dinwiddie's ability to get to the basket whenever the hell he wants. He's got long arms, so it can help defensively. He's another guard, which allows you to not have to play Mike James. No offense to Mike James, who played well early on in this series. But, yeah. Yeah. But you know what? Why think about it? He's not healthy. I mean, you can't even think about him. Just like, I haven't mentioned Kyrie Irving's name. Or maybe I have, maybe in reference to him getting hurt. But he's not walking through that door. He's not playing tonight. And you've got to deal with the hand that's given to you. Every team left has had some kind of injury that varies on levels of importance. Right? Obviously, Kawhi Leonard jumps out at you. DiVincenzo being out for the Bucks is a big blow. I'm sure a Buck fan would say, hey, things are different if he's out there. That's a big blow for them. Danny Green is out for Philadelphia. You know, obviously, they all vary on levels of importance. No doubt about it. Kyrie Irving is a guy that they absolutely miss. Harden not being 100%, they absolutely miss. But I want to make this clear. Injuries are a part of sports. So I don't think you're making it an excuse when you analyze to say, hey, this team would be better if they're healthy. It would help this team if this guy was healthy. This has changed the look of a series. That's not an excuse, nor is it going to make me or anyone else feel better if the Nets lose tonight. I can promise you that. Though I've been getting a lot of, ever since I opened up my DMs last week, I get a lot of weird questions. And I got one about 20 minutes ago. And I know why the guy did it, but I'll give him the attention. Let me find this guy because it was kind of funny. Frank DeFranco says, if the Nets lose tonight, who had the better season, the Knicks or the Nets? And I saw that and I'm like, who cares? What do you mean who had the better season? Is that how pathetic we are as Knicks and Nets fans that we're going to debate that? You can decide how you feel as a Knicks fan. I'll tell you, I'm going to be massively disappointed if they lose tonight, period, despite all the injuries. I'm still going to be massively disappointed. Couple minutes after whatever time it is, 11 a.m. Actually, let's count time by saying how many hours until game seven. So that would be, we are 9 hours and 25 minutes away. And we also have a game four with the Islanders and the Tampa Bay Lightning trying to stop the two-game slide and even that series up at 2-2. And hopefully, I would say not commit dumb penalties, but the Pelech penalty wasn't a dumb penalty. It wasn't a penalty. You know, I mean, it just wasn't. And it obviously changed the look of that game. So we've got a Nets game 7, an Islanders game 4, and the baseball teams are playing in a couple of hours. The Mets are going to play twice. They've got a doubleheader against Washington. On the Yankees last night, and I'll guess the turning point in a second, though I'd have to imagine it's fairly easy. I mean, it was the same story last night. You know, despite what they did in Buffalo, which was great, they swept the Blue Jays, they hit the ball well, Haroldis Chapman held on for dear life, they turned a crazy triple play. It's almost like they took their base running issues and somehow put it on the Toronto Blue Jays. But last night was sort of the same thing. You know, Jameson Taillon wasn't bad, but he wasn't great. He continues to get ahead of hitters and then give up bombs. The Matt Olson home run right out of the gate, two outs in the first thing, it was the same thing. Guys ahead 0-2. That was his problem against the Phillies last week. And how many times in that first inning that he couldn't get out of was he giving up base hits ahead in the count? So Taillon was better, but still not great. I have no issue with when Boone took him out, especially with Olson coming up in the fifth inning and going lefty-lefty with Wandy Peralta. And it worked. And then Wandy Peralta gives up the bomb to Tony Kemp. And sure, that's a headline. But the other headline is that the Yankee bats did nothing. I mean, it's, and that's the point when I say it's the same old story. They scored 3 runs on 4 hits. And I'm sorry, we're not putting James Caprillion, the former Yankee prospect, in the Hall of Fame. I know Petit's good and Diekman's good and Trevino's had a very good year, but they couldn't touch the Oakland A bullpen, and they flat out couldn't hit besides the DJ opposite field home run and Odor going deep. And so what hurt the Yankees last night, what stopped their winning streak, was the same issues they've had all year, which you start to feel is just never going to change on a consistent basis, and that's the offense. Aaron Judge had an awful night outside of that base hit in the sixth inning. He was striking out a million times. Giancarlo cooled off. They didn't have Gary Sanchez till they pinch hit in the seventh inning. They got nothing offensively. It's the same old story. I got nothing to rip Aaron Boone for. I don't have any issues with how he handled his bullpen last night. Look, Wandy Peralta made a bad pitch, and he failed against a left-hand hitter. Bottom line is they couldn't hit. And as we sit here in the middle of June, that story has remained the same. And that's why I know Craig was skeptical. After you win those 3 games against the Blue Jays, and you say, okay, maybe they're coming out of it. Maybe this is it. Now, Oakland's had a tremendous year. They're 17 games above 500. They have now been consistently good the last couple of years, so it's not any kind of bad competition, but it goes back to the same issues that they have had, and that's their problems offensively. So I may as well get it out of the way. The Yankee turning point from last night, and I think I'm 6-for-7 so far this season, has to be the Tony Kemp 3-run bomb in the sixth inning as the Yankees had themselves a 3-2 lead, and then it disappeared. And by the way, every Yankee fan knew the game was over. I mean, at that point, I know you got 12 outs to work with. You just felt, all right, we're done. So here it is, the turning point from last night's Yankee game.
Now the 2-2, swung on and drilled to right field. Back is Judge. That ball is gone. A 3-run home run for Tony Kemp. And the Oakland A's now take a 5-3 lead, a line drive in the lower seats in right.
Yeah, and I think that was the first home run Peralta's given up to a lefty. But either way, same story. Yankees lose to the Oakland A's, and really it's about the offense. Gary's going to be back in the lineup, which is a plus. He didn't play last night. And the fact that it's a day game after night game, look, he wasn't going to play today if he played last night. But Sanchez has been one of their best hitters. As far as the Mets are concerned, look, they're in first place. They continue to get help in the fact that the division's not very good. Philadelphia lost last night. They continue to get really good starting pitching. I thought what Joey Lucchese did last night is really encouraging. And I actually love the way Rojas managed it too. He lets him go third time around the order. Great, finally. He gets the first out. Great. All right, keep him in. Gives up the hit to Turner and says, all right, lefty-lefty against Soto, I'll give you one more batter. I'll give you a shot. That didn't work. Now, luckily, Soto didn't park one. He walked, and then he makes the move to Castro, who turns the big double play against Ryan Zimmerman. So the positive is Joey Lucchese looked good, and he took a little bit more of a step to being a real starting pitcher. Because when you pitch into the sixth inning, even you know, I know we have different standards in 2021, but if you pitch into the sixth inning, I can consider you a starting pitcher. If you're taking out the fourth inning consistently, you're not a starting pitcher. That's why Tyone is moving backwards. I don't know if he's a starter anymore. So that was the positive. And the Met bullpen, Castro did a great job, looped it okay. And then we get to the Lugo Diaz thing. And I'll be honest with you. Lugo comes in, gets a big strikeout, and yes, I'm fully expecting that Seth Lugo is going to pitch the ninth inning. Like, why wouldn't he? And he doesn't, and they go to Diaz, and we all know what happens. Kerwin Danley had a mess of a night behind the plate. Mess of a night. I mean, he was awful, including the strike three call he missed on Soto. We all know it was a strike. Rojas knows it was a strike. Even Diaz after the game, very matter-of-factly, says, I struck him out on the 3-2 pitch. And look, Ryan Zimmerman didn't rip the baseball when he went the other way, and I think Soto was running on the pitch. But Yan Gomes, did rip the 2-2 pitch for a base hit, and the Mets did lose. So Diaz did give up a run, and yes, he's not nearly as good at non-save situations. My opinion on that is get good at non-save situations. I'm serious. Because there's going to be a big game in September, hopefully a game in October, in which it won't be a save situation, but you're going to trust Edwin Diaz more than anyone else in that Met bullpen. There's a chance that's going to be the case. So you know what? Whether you're Edwin Diaz or you're Aroldis Chapman or whoever the heck you are, get better in non-save situations. Sorry, that's just the reality of it. That's why Billy Wagner didn't pitch the ninth inning of Game 7 in 2006. That's why Aaron Heilman was out there against Yadier Molina. Who would you trust, Billy Wagner or Aaron Heilman? But Billy Wagner wasn't out there because he continued to struggle in non-save situations. So my answer to this is don't be afraid of Edwin Diaz in non-save situations. Pitch him in non-save situations so finally he'll be comfortable pitching in non-save situations. We good with that? Does that make sense? All right. The Lugo Diaz thing doesn't even bother me that much. Why, you ask? Because they couldn't score a run. And they weren't even really rallying ever in this game. I think they had a couple of leadoff walks. That's it. So you can get nuts about the decision and the comment Luis made after the game about why Lugo only faced one batter, the up-downs, the amount of pitches he threw a few days ago. Fine. They couldn't hit. Now, here's the good news about the Mets' lack of offense, which is now bordering on absurd. 21 consecutive innings without a run. Here's the really good news. They've got horses coming back. If this was 3 weeks ago, I'd be panicking. I would. And I was. I think most Met fans saw all the injuries they had and started to say, how the heck are you going to survive this? They have done a great job surviving it. They have thrived. We've learned to really like guys like Billy McKinney and even Mason Williams and Jonathan Villar. And of course, Kevin Pillar, who was always going to be a big part of this team anyway. But this is the perfect time to get guys back because reality is starting to sink in. You know, the Mets starting pitching and bullpen has been mostly great this season. Last night was great, but if you can't score any runs, it doesn't matter how great your pitching is. The Miami Marlins have pitched really well this year. Look at their record. So that's why I'm sort of relaxed, even though I don't know how this weekend's going to go. I mean, they could very well lose the two games today. I mean, this could be a disastrous weekend. Totally understand that. But the good news is they've built themselves a cushion, and they finally have the horses coming back. It's no longer a theory. Jeff McNeil is coming back. Michael Conforto is coming back. Now, I don't know if those guys just walk through the door and hit 350. I mean, the Mets offense was struggling before those injuries occurred, but there's more validity to this lineup if you get guys like that back. And that's a big help. So, yeah, it's bad. 21 straight innings without a run, no doubt. Yeah, it was a frustrating loss. But I think the best news you could have as a Met fan is that despite that, A, they've built themselves a cushion. They're still 4.5 up in the National League East on Philadelphia, who lost last night. I still fear the Braves, who did win last night, decisively. But not only have you built the cushion, you've got the horses coming back. And that's a big deal. And that's a big help as this team moves forward. How was soccer, Jed? Did you like it? Did you have a good time?
Yeah.
Yeah? All right, buddy. Son just walked in. He played soccer today. Do you think the Nets are going to win tonight, honestly? You want to come over here for a second? All right, let's see if he really thinks this. All right. This is my son, Jet. First of all, how was soccer?
Good.
Did you score any goals?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Not bad. All right. Nets against the Bucks tonight. I want you to be honest with me.
Yeah.
Who's going to win tonight?
The Brooklyn Nets.
The Brooklyn Nets?
Yeah.
Yeah, my man. Give me a hug. That's right. That's my boy. All right, you can sit down now. All right, we'll come back and get back to your calls. By the way, the line on tonight's net game, it's kind of stayed firm, but right now it's sitting at the Nets -1.5. So basically a pick 'em, essentially, Nets Bucks tonight. I saw it initially at Nets -1, then it jumped up to 2. So it's pretty much in the same range. They're laying 1.5 tonight for a game 7 against Milwaukee. Sixers are pretty big favorites tomorrow, which you'd expect, 7.5 at home against Atlanta. Now, let me get back to your phone calls. We'll touch on DeGrom's injury stuff and the Yankee and Met lineups, which finally came out. Let's go to our buddy Harvey in Dix Hills. What's up, Harvey?
Hi, Evan. That was special with your son. I love that.
Thank you. It's he's a good man. You're a good man, Jet.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
Right. It brings back memories from my childhood, too. So.
Yes. Thank you.
But anyway, I was very interested in a public statement by Alonzo that there's a conspiracy conspiracy going on, but he said it was based on free agency.
Right.
And I don't agree. I know there's I believe there's a conspiracy, but that's not the conspiracy. And it started 2 years ago with Commissioner Manfred when he decided to so-called juice up the baseballs to put more offense back in baseball. But the problem is, as I mentioned on your show at the time, is that he never negotiated that with the Players Association, and he lied about it, telling all of us that there was nothing wrong with the baseballs. So fast forward to now with the sticky stuff scandal. You know, I heard one pitcher say, you know, all we want is an equal playing field. Well, the bottom line is that 2 years ago, the conspiracy was against the pitchers to increase more offense.
Right.
And the sticky stuff scandal is also against the pitchers. And I think that there's this divide developing between the pitchers and the position players as we speak. But my question to you has there ever been a equal playing field? Do we want an equal playing field? What do you feel about this whole issue of equal playing fields, for example?
Well, it comes down to, what do we want baseball to look like? All right. Do we want a lot of offense in the game? Do we want pitching to dominate? Do we want a lot of strikeouts? Do we want to cut down on strikeouts? Because I don't think this is a conspiracy. I think it's down to the fact that the numbers offensively were so far down this year and the strikeouts were so high up that the commissioner looked at it and said, this is bad for baseball. This is boring. This is going to hurt our sport moving forward. And so I think a part of why they've gone after the sticky stuff is, yeah, do they want to create a divide between players, which Cody Decker brought up to Craig and I a few weeks ago? Maybe. Maybe that's like an added bonus to it. But I think it's squarely he wants offense in baseball because he thinks offense in baseball sells. And by the way, he may not be wrong. So what's tricky about all of this is what's cheating, you know, whether it's sign stealing or sticky stuff. So we went out yesterday, and we made a video out of it. We had a lot of fun and spent a lot of time making fun of each other, but it was fascinating. We went out and had a Rapsodo machine, and we have this video up. You can follow me at Evan Roberts, WFAN. And the Rapsodo machine not only tests your velocity, but it tests your spin rate. Now, we're not major leaguers, but me, Craig, C-Mac, we all went out and we pitched. And look, we didn't throw that hard. I topped out at 59. Craig topped out at 58. C-Mac was in the mid-50s. So you can see we're not major leaguers. But they tested our spin rate. And I'll give you a great example. We all were kind of in the same range just throwing a baseball, about 1,200 RPMs, which is way below major leaguers. But again, we're not major leaguers, about 1,200 RPM. We then applied spider tack mixed with suntan lotion. All did it. Had fun doing it. And then we threw. For me, my velocity was about the same. And my spin rate jumped 300 RPM. And that's me. I'm not a major leaguer, and I'm not even trying to throw curveballs or sliders, and I had a pretty big increase in my RPM. Craig had a pretty big increase in his RPM. His velocity went down, and I actually will defend him as much as I, you know, we make fun of each other. He got tired. That was Craig's problem. He was tired. He's old. He's a little older. He claims he has a shoulder injury. He wore down, but his spin jumped. Big Mac, spin jumped. This is us. So the point of all this is we can't deny that, yeah, you can use Spider Tack and you can use suntan lotion to improve your grip. And I absolutely felt a difference. Felt a difference gripping the baseball. But there was consequences to it, which meant the ball was spinning more. And logic tells you if the RPMs are jumping, it's tougher to hit. So that's just us doing it. Now, we know what the RPM jump is going to be for Gerrit Cole, Trevor Bauer, and guys like that. So we all have to ask ourselves a question. Are we okay with that? Is that fair? Is that right? What's our take on that? And I got to be perfectly honest with you. I don't know. I really don't. Is it cheating? I guess there's a line where you say, okay, this is over it. So this is cheating. But we always knew about guys trying to scuff the baseball, and we consider that cheating. So it is one gigantic gray area. But I think what this whole thing has come down to is that the commissioner and a lot of people around baseball want the offense to jump. They want batting averages to go up. They want offense to go up because they think that sells the game more. And I can't deny that. Like, I have my views. You listen to me. You know I'm a geek for great pitching. Sure, but that's just me. That doesn't mean I represent most casual baseball fans or even diehard baseball fans. So the big issue I'd have in this is doing it in the middle of the year. Like, you almost have to lay in the bed that you made and then at the end of the year evaluate. And I do think you should talk to players. I don't think these are decisions that should be made on your own. I think you've got to talk. Doesn't mean you've got to listen to what every player says, but Gerrit Cole's right when he says talk to us. You should talk to the players and try to get a consensus. But that's what good leaders do. And Rob Manfred's not a good leader. Now, it's easy to see the skill sets of a good leader. Reading presidential history, you could see it. You could kind of pick out the great leaders and the terrible leaders. And I'm not going to get into which is which because, you know, that'll tick people off, I'm sure. But Rob Manfred's not a good leader. I'm sorry. I'm just being honest. I'm looking at the way he's run baseball, and that's not leadership. Leadership is getting people in a room and trying to build a consensus. I'm sorry. It's not about my way or the highway. But that's just my view. That's my view on leadership. What the heck do I know? Rick in Tampa. Hey, Rick.
Hey, man. What's up, buddy?
What's up, man?
You know what? I want to give you a little anxiety relief for the Nets. But first, I got to ask you, what did you think of Finale for The Handmaid's Tale?
I haven't watched it yet. And you haven't watched it?
Oh, all right.
Boy, it's funny that my wife just walked in the room. She walked in and she left. She took Jet. They're going to go do something. My wife has said to me 3 days in a row now, I get there's a lot of sports. I get the Nets are in the playoffs. But we need to watch Handmaids. So I promised her at some point tomorrow, I'm going to watch Handmaids. And I promise you, Rick, I will give you my opinion. Now, do us all a favor. Don't say a freaking word about
the
finale.
I'm glad I didn't, because I thought the way you were talking yesterday, it was already over. But then the way you said to Craig about having to watch it, I'm like, did you? This was one more episode. You didn't see it.
No, didn't see it.
Yeah, all right, good. I'm not saying a word. Not saying a word. I'll talk to you next Saturday and ask you that question next.
Beautiful.
So let me just appease you a little bit about the Nets. Obviously, I'm not a Nets fan, but the three things that are going to for you guys to win. And looking at it from a person who's not angst about us game seven, because if it was my team, I'd be nervous wreck all day. KD is the best player, and he will be the best player on the court. The freak can't make free throws. That's going to help you out as well. And when they can't cover KD, that's going to leave Harden open, and he's going to be Harden and drain him, and he's healthier this game. So there you go. Those four things are going to be for you guys to win, and calm down. You'll be all right.
Thank you, Rick. Now I'm going to curse you out when they don't win, and I'll say, "At Rick, he tried to calm me down 9 hours ago, and it was all for naught." The most encouraging thing in my brain is how Harden played in game six. That, you know, I'm glad James went out there in game five. I didn't rip him at halftime, even though he played awful in the first half. because I appreciate that he was making the effort to get out there. And I thought he was much better in the second half as a playmaker, as a willing defender. And I think game six, he was much better in all aspects. And so it does give me hope that the jump from 5 to 6 may also see a jump from game 6 to 7. And that is certainly encouraging. But thanks for the attempt, Rick. I appreciate it. Louie in the Bronx. Hey, Louie.
Hey, what's up, man? You know, Evan, and I see you got your son brainwashed, by the way, with the book.
Brainwashed? I asked him a question. He gave an answer. What do you want from me?
Okay. You're molding him good. But I'll tell you something. You know, first of all, before I get to the baseball, you said Oakland 17 games over. And remember how they started the season until that
game. No, you're right. You're right.
They were, 1-7 or something like that? Right?
Yeah. They got off to a bad start. Yep.
Well, and the Jazz series, make no mistake about it. Mike Connolly, not having Mike Connolly, killed him. He's underrated great, that kid.
Totally agree. But Louis, the point, I 100% agree, and you know, you could even make the argument, and maybe you'll agree with this, that Connolly not playing for Utah and then being a shell of his former self is clearly a bigger blow than even Kawhi not playing for the Clippers. I mean, based on the important level of each player and the way Paul George has stepped up. But here's the truth. Every single team left has had some kind of injury that's impacting them, and we all just have to deal with it.
And that's why in game 6, I wouldn't have played Harden, because he did have a safety net. It would have gave him 2.5 days of resting, because he took a major, major risk. Because if this guy comes up lame again, you lose him for 7.
Yeah.
And that's why I would have sat him for 6.
But
I would have sat him out, Harden.
But
right? And let them go to battle with KD.
But Louis, I totally get where you're coming from, but here's my counter to that. He's getting his legs back. He had no legs in game 5, okay? He got his legs back in game 6. He played better. Like I just said, he played better. Was he a superstar? No. Was he James Harden? No, but he was better. So maybe being out there, even though, sure, you risk injury, of course you do, any step he takes could be the end of his season. We all understand that. That could help him tonight. I mean, if he's going to take another jump, and let's say he does take another jump, don't you think being out there in game 6 actually may have helped him? So I get what you're saying. You could have gone into game 6 and been ultra conservative. Reggie Miller got a lot of heat on Twitter because right after they won game 5, he went even further. He suggested they don't even play Durant. Like, hand them game 6 and make sure that both guys are fully rested going into a game 7. First of all, I can't do that. There's no way Durant would have ever done that. But in Harden's case, there's a chance if he takes another step in game 7, we're going to look back at the way he played in game 6 and say, hey, that kind of helped. And to his point about Oakland, they started the year off 0-6. They got swept by the Astros. They lost the first 2 games against the Dodgers. They were 0-6, and then they went on a rampage. And now the Oakland, how many have they won in a row now? Like 6 in a row? 7 in a row? Whatever it is. 44-27. For the Oakland A's. So, yeah, no, they're legitimately good. No doubt about it. Legitimately good. Let's go to Rich in White Plains. What's up, Rich?
Hey, Evan. Full disclosure, I'm a Met fan, so just want to qualify that with what I'm about to say. Let's talk a little bit about the sad saga of Francisco Lindor as a New York Met.
Okay.
That the Met Public Relations Division and the broadcast team, they won't even go near it. I mean, let's not forget that this guy held out until opening day to get every freaking thing he wanted, okay?
Right.
And now he's batting .209, and we're over a third of the way through the season. He just committed his 4th error of the year, and the very next night they did an ode to his defense, which I couldn't understand that. He's been ordained. Ordained, I use that word intentionally, as a leader by the Mets.
So you don't believe that? You don't think that's true?
I think he has a big mouth.
You're rough, man. I mean, I respect where you're coming from, but that's right. You just think he has a big mouth? You don't think he's respected and is a leader on that team in the locker room?
I haven't heard another player say it yet.
But you don't notice watching him, the way he comes to the pitcher's mound in big spots, the way he puts his arm around guys. And I'm not saying I know what he's saying. We don't. But you don't get the impression watching the Mets every day that he is a respected leader on that team?
Evan, you can act like a leader, and then you can be a leader. It's like being respected and earning respect.
But what makes you think he's just acting that way and isn't truly a leader? What gives you that impression?
Because watching his interviews and watching him all the way around, I just don't think, like the old saying says, you lead by example first, okay?
Look, Rich, one thing I can't argue with you about is how bad he's been offensively. I mean, I can't argue with you. He's been a massive, massive disappointment, and I think he's taken less heat recently because, A, they're winning, and, B, even though you don't agree with it, clearly, there is a perception he is the leader of this team, and he has been good defensively. I'm sorry. I know you want to cite the error the other night and say, see, he's not that good. Francisco Lindor, you watch him every day, and I think you do. You know he's been great defensively. So I think those two aspects that you're poo-pooing, his defense and his leadership, are actually fair things. And this may surprise you, or maybe it won't surprise you, but Joe was nice enough to call me a couple days ago to console me after the Kyrie injury, and things looked bad. And I did appreciate that. And we talked a little bit about the Mets, and we talked about Lindor, and Joe never loved that trade. I'm not sure we talked that much about it on the air, but he didn't love it. You know, he loved Andrés Giménez, didn't love the trade. And he told me, you know what, bro? He's a leader. He plays great defense. Really starting to like Lindor. So even he looks at it the way I think a lot of Met fans look at it. And Rich seems to be blaming SNY and the media. Like, we're all trying to make Lindor look better than he looks. That's not it. Let's be honest. His offense has been brutal. I'll say that over and over again. And I did even say to Joe in that conversation, I'll say it now, he's got a hit, okay? As great as his leadership may be and his defense has been, and I do believe his defense has been great, I disagree with our last caller, he can't hit .213. It can't happen. He can't have 6 home runs and 16 RBIs in late June. It can't happen. So I agree with all of that. He has got to wake up offensively. You're not paying a guy $300+ million to hit .215. I'd be the first to tell you that. But in saying that, you don't then have to bash everything else he does. He is a really good defensive shortstop. And while we're not in the room to know 100%, he does come across like the leader of this team. So it's easy, just separate it. It's not that difficult to do. We can separate it. Lindor has been god-awful offensively, but he's been really good defensively, and he looks like the leader of this team. Like, you can say both things. I just did. It ain't that difficult. Now, if he continues to not hit and the Mets winning starts to dissipate, then yes, the voices will get louder saying, you gotta start hitting. And every time it looks like he's about to start hitting, he cools off and goes through a slump like he's going through right now. It's crazy. It really is. More of your calls coming up. Plus, what does the Met and Yankee lineup look like? And thoughts on why Jacob DeGrom got hurt? And did it have something to do with him swinging a bat? And how does a pro pitcher hitting guy like myself react to that? It's all coming up. Evan Roberts here on The Fan till the Yankee pregame show. It does make me nervous every time James Harden dribbles. That is true, especially in Game 5 when he first made his return. Like, every movement James had or made, there was this fear of, did he re-aggravate it? How's the hammy? And I even kept an eye on his pregame ritual, because James Harden has a pregame ritual where he runs into the post underneath the basket. That's his ritual. That's his thing. That's what he does. And I saw him do it, thinking, is he still going to do it? Because he's got, like, a bad hamstring. And he still did it. And I'm so worried about it. Yeah, Zoo, you got to do me a favor. Can you do me a favor?
What is it?
You got to get me a doctor on the air in the next, like, 5 minutes or something, because I got a lot of questions I need to get off my mind about Harden and even Kyrie Irving. So pull some producer magic. Get me some, you know, well-connected, you know, sports medicine expert doctor surgeon, and let me know when you have that person on the air. All right, Zoo?
All right, give me a second here. Let me see what I can get in the medical community.
All right. So besides eating bread and going down to Atlanta and being a lovable personality, this guy knows how to produce, and I trust him. If I asked Loogie this, it'd probably take about 45 minutes. Nah, I'm just kidding. Loogie would do a great job. But Zoo, I've got confidence in. Just because there's a few things I got to get off my mind. Because I'm no doctor. I'll tell you that right now. But as a sports fan, you almost have to be a doctor because of all the injuries that we're dealing with and that we watch. And that impacts our, like, daily life watching sports.
All right. Well, you won't believe this, brother, but I actually I came through for you.
Look at you. Look at you. Oh, look, and you already texted me the information. My God, how the hell did you do that?
Hey, it's our good friend Dr. Bishop over at Rothman. You know what it is.
Yes, we welcome Dr. Bishop, sports medicine surgeon at Rothman Orthopedics. To learn more about their New York offices, go to RothmanNY.com. Dr. Bishop, Evan Roberts, how are you?
Hey, Evan, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for coming on. So I've got a couple of things. When you have a hamstring issue, and like the Nets haven't revealed like what type of strain James Harden had, I understand that. But is there a risk that are you riskier to re-injure yourself when playing sooner than maybe the rest indicated when you're on playing on an injured hamstring?
Definitely. I mean, the main risk of going back too early with a hamstring injury is that you can re-injure again, potentially have a more significant injury to the hamstring. The main risk factor of re-injuring your hamstring is a prior history of having a hamstring injury. And James Harden, you know, dealt with that for a lot of the season this year. So he's obviously not at 100% trying to play through it right now, but he does have a risk of injuring it more significantly and really injuring something else if you are kind of compensating and not
right.
Performing the same way, the way you want to be and moving the way you want to be. You potentially could hurt something else.
You know, we think back to Durant a couple of years ago where he came back too early on a calf issue and then tore his Achilles, and obviously that was catastrophic. Is there anything catastrophic? Not just, hey, you're injured his hamstring, he's out for the playoffs, which would be bad, but something even more serious that could affect him long term that's at risk because he's playing right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. That was very unfortunate with KD's injury in the playoffs with tearing his Achilles with that. This isn't quite the same thing. The chances of him like actually, you know, fully tearing his tendon off the bone with the hamstring would be incredibly low because this is more of a kind of a muscle type injury
right.
rather than the tendon attachment to the bone. So, I mean, he could certainly tear his hamstring worse in the muscle belly, but which would kind of just extend his recovery time. But I would not expect this to become a surgical issue in the future if he does make it worse.
All right. That's good to know. Now, I feel bad even asking this because if the Nets lose tonight, it's completely irrelevant. But I'll ask it anyway just so I know about it in the back of my mind. Realistically, when you sprain your ankle the way Kyrie Irving did, what's a realistic timeline for him to return and play basketball again?
So, I don't know based on the MRI if they said whether or not it was considered necessarily a high ankle versus a low ankle sprain. But it seems to me like this is probably more just a significant lower ankle sprain based on looking at the injury and kind of how they're describing it. If we actually like have data on this in the NBA and people that have just normal low ankle sprains, this would be an average of 2 games and return to play in 8 games. So for normal low ankle sprains with the NBA players, that's what we've found they've done in the past. They're usually back in 8 games. The higher ankle sprains, as we know, LeBron had that this season.
Yeah.
It was, was out for quite a long time. It's actually a lot longer. It's the average of 5 games you miss and up to 24 days. So, hopefully this is more the lower ankle sprain and he's kind of looking towards 8 days and 2 games. So this is now way on 3 games missed. But my hope would be, if they win tonight, he'd be ready either by game 1 or game 2 of next week.
Oh, that's good. I don't want to think too much about it, but that's very good. Hey, one last thing, Doc, while we have you on the phone. Is a flexor tendon injury related to a shoulder injury, which could be related to a side injury? And the only reason I ask that is those are 3 separate injuries Jacob deGrom has had, and he has said none of it's related. And maybe it isn't. I don't know. You know more than I do. It's just weird that he keeps having injuries. So would a flexor tendon injury be related to a shoulder injury, and would a side injury be, connected to any of those 2 injuries?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like there's probably something off in his kinetic chain, with pitching. Pitching is not necessarily it just using your shoulder or your elbow. It's a whole body motion, obviously. So if there's something off in the way he's throwing, he certainly could be overcompensating with his side versus his shoulder versus his, flexor tendons at the elbow. So, I would expect there might be something biomechanically a little bit off that could be contributing to these injuries. So it's definitely possible that they could be related.
Interesting. All right, Doc. I really appreciate it. You gave me a lot of information,
of
all of us listening. So great stuff. Really appreciate you coming on. Thank you, Doc.
Excellent. You're welcome. Have a good one.
You too. That's Dr. Bishop from Rothman Orthopedics. And you can learn about their New York offices by going to RothmanNY.com. Zoo, man, you're good. I got to tell you. You're more than just a pretty face is what we're learning about you. Much more than a pretty face. So good job out of you. And I hope, I really hope, I shouldn't say this. Ah, whatever. I'm just going to go with it. I really hope that I'm texting you tomorrow night, Zoo, asking you about places to hang out in Atlanta. I really hope that's a conversation you and I are having, but it's probably not going to happen. So that text conversation is probably not going to occur. I'll get to the Jake thing at 12 noon. I'll give you my thoughts on everything going on with him. But let me get to a few more of your calls, like our buddy Joe and Clark, who's waited a while. What's up, Joe?
Evan, baby, what's up, kid?
What's up, baby?
I'm rooting hard for you tonight, kid. You know, I'm a Jet Net and a Seahawks fan. I don't have a pro basketball team, but I will root hard for you because I'd like to see you get a championship.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Joe. You're a good man.
Couple things, you know, and you know how I've been on Lindor. You know, I think I'm going to lead the bandwagon on Twitter, on here. I mean, it's just, and you know, we talked a couple of times, and last month we talked, and it's like, it's getting late early. I mean, you know, it's starting to get to the point where you say, well, let the season play on. He's awful. And, you know, I was at the game the other night, and I'm watching Baez. I poked my friend. He hit the ball in the apple. I said, you kidding me? We could have had this guy get his 40 home runs. We could have had him for even more than less than half of what they paid Lindor. I mean, just you watch his at bat. He looks like an old lady up there, weak. Baez looks like, you know, Bonds in his prime, the way he swings compared to Lindor. Let me just say one thing. You got to take him out of the two-hole. You got to take him out of two-hole. I understand who do you put there, but he's just he's an automatic out.
Let Jake play when he's not pitching. I guarantee you
he'll get more hits. You can bet your life.
We're going to get into that, the fact he got hurt swinging. So maybe that's not the best idea. I'd be all for dropping Lindor. I pushed Rojas about that about a month and a half ago. But I pushed him on it when the Mets had other options. I mean, what are their options right now? Like, where is the lowest spot in the order you could conceivably hit Francisco Lindor? I'd like the idea of leading him off to try to change the mentality and kind of say, look, get on base, be a table setter. Kind of go with that thought as opposed to Jonathan Villar, who's mostly let off. But until McNeil and Conforto are back, and Nimmo is back, whenever that happens, they really don't have the ability to drop him in the order. But here's the good news. Lindor's hitting .210, whatever it is. Went into last night hitting .213. He was 0-for-4. So .209, whatever he's at. They're still winning. And so anything he does now, especially if he gets back to the numbers we expect, I mean, you're going to love him. Like, he can get hot. And even during his struggles, they're 8 games above .500. So that's the positive you could take out of it. Come right back, DeGrom. My thoughts on how he got hurt and if this changes my view on the DH, plus plenty of time for your calls and both the Mets and Yankees starting lineups. 2-0-2 on the fan, our final little bit of time together before an incredible day and night in New York sports. The Mets are playing a doubleheader. The Yankees are trying to even up the series against Oakland. The Islanders are trying to even up the best of seven series against the Tampa Bay Lightning at Nassau. And the Nets are trying to move on and avoid elimination against the Bucks in a Game 7 tonight at Barclays Center. All right, here's the thing about DeGrom. Look, I have been a proponent of the pitcher hitting. Jacob DeGrom injuring himself swinging the bat while disappointing is not going to change my view on the rule. That would make me an incredible hypocrite. You know, to say, oh, my pitcher got hurt. Now I hate the pitcher hitting. I don't feel that way. Of course, I don't want Jacob DeGrom to get hurt. Every time Jake takes the mound and every time Jake swings the bat, I am nervous as a Met fan. Not only as a Met fan, as Jake being my favorite player. Like, I want him out there. But I got a lot of tweets and DMs saying, hey, does it make you reevaluate your opinion on the DH? Why would it? You know, I understand pitchers can get hurt. I've seen it. I've seen Jake get hurt swinging the bat a couple of years ago in a game against the Braves. I think he'd thrown 4 no-hit innings too, something like that. He swung the bat, hurt his shoulder, missed a start. Yankee fans certainly know full well about what happened to Chen Ming Wong. Basically ruined his career running the bases against the Houston Astros. So I get it. There are a lot of ways you can get hurt in baseball. You can get hurt by comebackers. That doesn't mean we should have a pitching screen in front of the pitchers. So, no, it doesn't change my view on the rule. Now, I know what's going to happen with the rule. And I'm no longer fighting it. Like, there's going to be a DH in Major League Baseball next year. And yes, that helps in one aspect of baseball, preventing injuries. You got it. Yes, you're right. But that's not going to change my view on my overall thought on the rule. The question here and the problem here is, what are you supposed to do with Jacob DeGrom? He is the best pitcher on the planet. He's an incredible competitor. It's a privilege watching him pitch every 5 days. And yet it feels as if this is happening on borrowed time, because every time there's a scare, and this year there's been a lot of them, you fear the worst. You fear, uh-oh, this is the big one. And in years past, Jacob DeGrom has always had a scare. If you remember last year in the oddity of 2020, Jacob DeGrom had a back issue right out of the gate in July as the Mets were getting ready to revamp up for the 2020 season. That was a scare. The year before that, he had a scare. I just mentioned the scare in which he injured himself swinging the bat against the Atlanta Braves. So I've grown used to the fact that Jake gets a scare every year. Maybe he misses a start and everything turns out to be okay. But what's happened this year is more than a scare. What's happening this year is deeply concerning, because there's something wrong with him every 5 days. And look, I know there's no easy answer. You know, my thought is, all right, I got to shut him down for a couple weeks. That's my thought. Does that mean it's going to fix everything? No. You know, the doctor said something and it's true. Maybe there's something off with the way he throws the baseball. Now, I get it. He injured himself swinging the bat in that one case. But again, I say it all the time because it concerns me. He throws harder than everybody else by a lot, consistently. No one else throws 100 or 101 nearly the amount of times as Jacob DeGrom. And while we're in awe of it, it's concerning, because not only do you want to see Jake pitch this year and hopefully pitch in October for the first time since he was magical for most of that 2015 run, you want Jacob DeGrom pitching into his late 30s. He's 33 years old. In fact, today's his birthday. And so you want to keep him healthy. And I just don't know if it's smart every 5 days to go through the same dance in which he dominates, he comes out early, and then everything's okay and he starts again. I mean, how many times in a row can you do that? Like, if he pitches Monday and the same thing happens, are you going to pitch him Saturday? I mean, when does it end? And I don't know if it's Jake's got to pitch through being uncomfortable. I threw that out a couple days ago. Does there come a point where Jake, as careful as he wants to be, has to say, yeah, I feel a little off here, but nothing's wrong with me. I got to keep going. Is that the answer? Is the answer resting him? Is the answer scientifically studying his pitching motion to figure out if there's something unhealthy about it? I don't know the answer. None of us does. But it is very concerning. And, you know, just... it feels like right now the Mets should be conservative. Despite a two-game losing streak, despite all the doubleheaders coming up, despite how much I'm sure Jake wants to be out there to chase what has been a historic start to his season, at some point you got to be smart and you got to be conservative. But no. Jacob DeGrom or any other pitcher injuring himself pitching is not going to change my view on pitchers hitting. It's just not. And if I did... what does that make me? It makes me a hypocrite. If all of a sudden I sat here and told you, now I want the DH, why, Evan? Because Jake hurt himself swinging? I always knew Jacob DeGrom and any other pitcher can get hurt swinging the bat. Of course, I get it. There's a risk. And by the way, Jacob DeGrom swings the bat incredibly well. That's the other crazy part. I mean, it's absurd how great he's been. All right, let's get to your calls. I'll give you the Met and Yankee lineups coming up in a couple. Let's go to Chris in Caldwell, New Jersey. What's going on, Chris?
What's going on, man?
What's up, man?
First, let's say let's go Nets tonight.
Yes.
Obviously, huge news. But I'm calling about DeGrom, and I was talking to Big Zoo. And just what you said, I couldn't agree more, man. I think they're just being reckless by letting him continue to pitch. And maybe the last injury was related to a swing, but like you said, there's been other nagging things that have come up this year. And it's just, you might not be related, all these injuries, but I don't know. I think they are. And, just curious your take on it, man. Because I think another thing, like you said, he throws so hard. Like, we don't need him to throw that hard. Throw, like, 96, 97. throwing that hard and at his age too? Like he's not getting any younger, obviously. And the body
I remember
declines.
No, you're right. And I remember Verlander used to do this a lot. I know Justin obviously just dealt with the Tommy John, but he would dial it up when he needed to. We've seen a lot of pitchers do that, where they save the gas for certain moments. And maybe that's what you got to do. I don't know if that's going to cure his injury problems, by the way. I think he can dominate. Jacob DeGrom has been a dominant pitcher long before he was throwing 100 and 101. But I always look at risk-reward sometimes when you're making these decisions. So the risk-reward with Jake pitching Monday, we know what the risk is. The risk is he injures himself again. The reward is, great, he's fine. If you shut him down for 2 weeks, just 2 weeks, I'm not saying a year, I'm not saying a month, 2 weeks, the risk-reward is what? The risk is, ooh, they may struggle in the two or three starts he doesn't make, okay. But the reward could be, maybe this helps. Maybe he doesn't have any more injury problems as the season rolls on. If this team was five games back, I probably would have a different view on it, but they're in a good spot where they can be conservative with it. And that's why shutting him down for a week or two, what's the negative to it? I guess is the real question. Jeff in Astoria. Good afternoon, Jeff.
I agree with you, Evan. I mean, there's something unhealthy about throwing a ball 100 miles an hour, and obviously the human body and the anatomy doesn't really agree with that. So you're right. Maybe the best way it is to shut him down. But a point before I get into this sticky substance solution, I haven't been following over the last week. Are you organizing a game with the fans? Just I guess more or less like an exhibition game. Sort of
between
goes or
between whom, like between shows.
I thought you were involving the fans in a game in terms of baseball.
The truth is, Jeff, I do it every Sunday. Now I haven't been able to go to every game, which I want to acknowledge, but I've run a league now called Fan Baseball, and the whole point of it is anyone can play. Fans play. Like everyone who plays in the league either listen to the show or followed on Twitter. So I do that every single Sunday. We have a game on Sunday. I think the rosters are packed for this Sunday, in fairness. But usually throughout the year, every Sunday, we have a game on Randall's Island. We have a game at College Point, Queens. And it's open to anybody. So if you want to play, the website is fanbaseballnyc.com. And you sign up. And usually I reach out to you. And okay. I've been doing that for a bunch of years. So you're, of course, more than welcome to come down and play for either the Bros or the Mongos or the Schmoozers or the Minkmen. It's all your option, Jeff.
All right. Well, listen, if you need a former D2 college pitcher, a lefty just like you that has nasty funk, you know what? Let's talk on the topic.
You're only on the Bros. The only team you can play for, Jeff, is my team, the Bros. Period. Stop.
All right. Well, let's see where it goes. So anyway, this fiasco with Sticky and whatever they're doing with it.
Right.
Listen, Garrett Cole is the poster child, but again, he is correct. And he's trying to resolve this. And he's saying that, hey, Rob Manfred, let's figure this out. And quite honestly, you know, the solution is here. Let's go back to the root cause of this. The root cause is there's obviously an issue with the rubbing mud and how the baseballs are rubbed up. And evidently they're not rubbed up to the pitcher's liking. So listen, I know like time is of the essence, and this is, I think we can all agree that this is probably the worst time to bring it up in season.
Yes.
But what you do is it's simple as this. It's like trying on a pair of glasses. You have five different baseballs, all with different, you know, ingredients of how to rub up a baseball. You present it to both sides and saying, like, pick the best grip to your liking, and let's all agree upon, you know, what is going to work
right
for the hitters.
There
as well
needs
as the
to
pitchers.
Be, and I agree with you, Jeff. There needs to be concrete rules on what's allowed and not allowed, and you should meet with the players in deciding that. But two things. Number one, you hit on, the timing is terrible. To do anything substantial like this in the middle of a season is not ideal. But this all comes back to something we were talking about on the radio a month ago, and that was the lack of action in baseball. That's what this whole thing is connected to. Strikeouts are up. Offense is down. there are fewer balls put in play. Remember, that was the big issue. Rightfully so. Huge issue. There's less action in baseball. That's not debatable. That's fact, right? And we all had different ideas. What can you do to add action to baseball? There's a lot of ideas. One of the things we talked about a month and a half ago is make the ballparks bigger. Maybe that'll cut down on launch angle and you won't have batters constantly swinging for the fences, right? All these different ideas. This whole thing is related to that because the commissioner's office says, well, maybe the reason why there's less contact in baseball is because the ball is spinning at a rate we've never seen before. And so it's tougher to hit. Let's just make it simple. It's tougher to hit. Is that the reason why strikeouts are up? Is that the reason why offensive numbers are down? So this is, to me, all connected to that. It's all connected to the fact that baseball doesn't like, and I understand why, because it's not good for the game, offense being down and action being down. And I've said it many times. There are a myriad of reasons for why. It's not one reason. One of the myriad of reasons is that the ball is spinning more. No doubt. I agree. One of the reasons is that batters aren't embarrassed at striking out. That's a factor too. So all of this and baseball deciding to act, to me, is it's all related to that one issue that was affecting the sport from the beginning of this season, and that was offensive numbers are way down. The problem is, and I think most of us could agree on it, is doing it now seems wrong. The other thing that we all have to decide as fans, and we've all been doing it for 40 years as baseball fans, is deciding what's cheating, what's wrong, what's unacceptable. We have all declared in one voice, right or wrong, that the Houston Astros are cheaters. Right? We all have. Most Yankee fans have. And yet, cheating like that goes on in baseball. But nobody has been caught as red-handed as the Houston Astros. Hence, they're cheaters and everyone else we barely talk about. We went through the steroid era a million times. No point bringing that up again. And now, with the spin rate of baseballs, it's coming down to, what do we consider cheating? And the best thing Gerrit Cole can do right now, because he's the face of it, fair or not, is pitch well. That's it. Because if Gerrit Cole goes out and pitches well, and I don't care what his strikeout numbers look like. He didn't strike out a lot of guys the other night. No Yankee fan cared. He went out, he pitched 8 innings, and he allowed 2 runs. If Gerrit Cole pitches well, then the issues around him or the controversy around him simply goes away. Because then you can say, hey, he's good either way. He's a great pitcher. It doesn't matter. Let's go to Steve in Cincinnati. What's up, Steve?
Hey, good morning. First of all,
good morning.
Happy early Father's Day to you.
Thank you. Happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there, and I appreciate it. Thank you, man.
So one quick thing I want to get to with you, as far as just that last call, baseball has absolutely no moral compass, and nor have they had a moral compass over history, going back to the fact that, you know, the Negro Leagues had to exist, and it's one snafu after another for the better part of now 100 years. So are you really surprised that the hierarchy of baseball does not know how to handle themselves properly? All baseball has
Losing you, but I totally get it. Yes, baseball's moral compass. And I think you brought up the best example and the most extreme example, and that's the ridiculous racism led by Judge Kennesaw Menton Landis and how they ran the sport until Jackie broke the color barrier in 1947. You're 100% right. And quickly about that, baseballreference.com, and everybody should check it out, has now added the Negro League stats as Major League stats because it's now considered Major League stats, and it always has been. I mean, if you're going to make the American Association and the Federal League a Major League stat, which they did 50 years ago, it was a disgrace for the last half a century that the Negro Leagues weren't considered a Major League stat. Okay? It was, it is, and I'm glad it's there. Let's take a look at this Yankee lineup. Nothing crazy. Clint's playing left field. I see that. Glaber's there. Giancarlo's there. Gary's batting third. Why not? Yankees A's coming up. Mets Nationals are about to play a doubleheader. David Peterson's on the mound in game one. So you got a good afternoon of baseball coming up. You'll hear it right here on The Fan with the Yankees. The pregame show is in a couple of minutes. And then tonight, light a candle, say a prayer to the basketball gods. It's the words that scare me half to death. Game 7. I'll do an instant reaction podcast either way, and it's going to be crazy. Enjoy the night. Go Nets.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.